sits at high at your helm. This sudden fear has left me trembling, 'cause now it seems that I am out here on my own, and I'm feeling so alone. Welcome to paradise.
Hi everyone, welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show, and I'm Ryan Ballingy. Thanks for being with us. You can get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy, and you can find Golf News Net on your favorite social media service at the handle Golf News Net. All of our work is available on golfnewsnet.com. Download the GNN Radio app if you so choose, or thanks for subscribing to us on whatever service you use, and make sure to download the GNN over-the-top TV app for your Roku and Amazon Fire boxes. Do it when you're done listening to this show, because doing it now is not going to be very helpful. We're presented by BetDSI.com. We love using their easy-to-use mobile interface. They have been paying winners for more than 20 years. You can bet on everything related to golf, whether that's winners, each-way bets, matchups, live in-game, and you can use that sports knowledge and your golf knowledge to turn a nice little profit for yourself. And if golf's not enough for you, of course, they have sports, they have politics, WWE, and pretty much anything else you think you could bet on. They've got it at BetDSI.com. You can use the promo code GOLFNEWS25 for a free $25 wager. And with that promo code, you also get a 200% bonus match on your first deposit. So head over to BetDSI.com, use that promo code GOLFNEWS25, get that free $25 wager, and do it again when you're done listening to this show. Okay, so we wanted to do two more podcasts this year before we get into 2018. One is going to be the topic of this show, primarily focused on what Tiger Woods did at the Hero World Challenge and maybe some prospects moving forward. And then we'll kind of do one more wrap-up show for the year, and that'll be our last podcast. So we'll have like a two-week break or something like that before we get into 2018 with the Century Tournament of Champions, the PGA Tour calendar kicking back up, and we'll go from there. And then the second half of the show will kind of be a consumer alert of sorts, and you'll understand what I mean when we get there, but I think it's something worth listening to because it's an absolutely insane story, okay? So let's start about Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods beat 8 guys out of 18 in the Hero World Challenge, and he looked good doing it. He opened 69-68. I think the 69 was probably the most pleasant golf surprise of the year, in my view, because I don't know what I expected of him, but I certainly don't think I believed he was going to break 70. And even on a resort-style course like Albany, which really isn't that difficult, but does have some difficult pain points, he played well. He drove the ball brilliantly in that first round. That tee shot, and I know Justin Thomas wasn't trying to rocket one 330, but that Tiger Woods hit his opening tee shot 330 and hit the fairway by an inch, I thought was a great sign. And it turned out that his driving was probably the best facet of watching him play. He could hit what he wanted. He didn't have to hit the squeeze cut. He didn't have to worry about the snap hook. He pretty much hit the drive that he wanted at the speed that he wanted. And he was swinging when he went after it in the area of 120 to 122 miles per hour. I think that's fantastic. And you should too, because that guy's had 4 back surgeries, including a spinal fusion in April, and he's swinging up there with the fastest swing speeds on the PGA Tour. I mean, week to week, usually that fastest swing speed is in the 124 to 125 mile per hour range, and that's a guy who's usually in his late 20s. This guy's nearly 42, will be in several weeks, and is swinging at that kind of level. His ball speed on the ones that he nuts with a 1.5 smash factor in the area of 180 miles per hour. And they were high towering drives when he wanted to hit them. So, I thought the other part that I really liked watching was the height of his shots. I feel like when he was with Sean Foley, he had gotten away from taking pride and relying on his height. Now, I probably say this as someone who, because I hit the ball high, I think other people should hit the ball high and embrace it. But Woods had kind of gotten away from that. He worried too much about the pro trodge and, you know, controlling his trodge and trodge. He talked about trodge way more with Sean Foley than he did almost in the entirety of his career otherwise. And I think that led him down the wrong path for who he is for a variety of reasons. Usually, if you're hitting lower, you're putting more strain on your back when you swing. You have to kind of find a way to squeeze the ball, which usually creates some kind of issue for your back. I'm not saying that guys who hit the ball low immediately have back problems, but for a guy who had back problems, for him to be hitting the ball lower was not a good idea. And I really liked watching him hit long irons high. That was, especially into par fives, the 2-iron that he hit from, what was it, 277 or something like that in the final round went long, but still smoked it with the recoil, which was cool, nostalgic, but not functional. But to watch him really go after shots and not be afraid to just smoke them high and let them ride and let them land. And I liked watching that. That felt like watching Tiger at his best. A guy who embraced his high ball flight, a guy who embraced that he could drop it down soft in an era when he dominated, when it was hard to stop a ball on a dime. And then we kind of got into the beginnings of the solid core ball, and it spun too much. And everyone could do it, and it kind of lost the allure. And that's why Tiger tried to find a way to get into a spinnier ball, even as they figured out how to make a solid core ball work without generating ungodly amounts of spin where you were sucking it back 30 and 40 feet and you weren't doing it on purpose. He wants that spin because it allows him to hit the ball high as he would like, and it would still come down and stop on a dime. You didn't have to whack it and squeeze it, as in his view, to put a lot of spin on the ball and get it to stop. We've obviously learned some things about how spin works through TrackMan, and that's not necessarily what you have to do. I mean, you don't have to play a spinny ball to hit it high. You just don't. That's not the way it works. That's not mechanics. That's not what science tells us. But at the time, that's what Woods went with and what he understood. He's still playing a little bit more of a spinny ball, I guess, but I feel like his decision to go with the Bridgestone Tour BXS as the ball, which is really more their distance ball. So he was worried more about distance with his feel than accuracy, so not necessarily being as spinny. So maybe that's an indicator that he feels like the modern golf ball is good enough that he wants a soft feel, but he also, which he's always wanted, but that he wants a couple of extra yards that maybe he can maximize a little bit better. So I find that really interesting. I find that an interesting choice. I mean, it's kind of on plane with what he went with when he went with the B330S ball when he first signed with Bridgestone, but I thought that was an interesting choice. The chipping obviously had some issues. You saw that. You saw him duff a few. He didn't really thin any, which, unless it was in a situation where he didn't have the best lie, but obviously he was more fat. He was hitting behind it, not through it, which I think is a positive thing. I think that if you have a consistent miss, you can fix the consistent miss more easily. So he was just struggling with two facets of things. One, he's hitting behind the ball a little bit too much, but he seemed to correct that in spots, and that seemed to be okay. And the other part of it was that Albany's grass is really tight to the ground. And in part, that's because of the hurricane season that was very aggressive and struck the Bahamas substantially, so that they weren't able to grow grass kind of in the normal way they would on the islands. So that led to a lot of spots being either bare or low or lacking density in grass. So maybe he found a couple of those. So that's somewhat understandable. It's obviously hard to pitch from a lie where there's not a lot of grass. That's a tight lie or a bare lie, and that's hard to perform. But that said, and we saw other guys hit terrible chip shots because they hit behind the ball, because they just couldn't gauge with the grass, or they went to the three wood like Justin Rose did, or the hybrid or putter off the green. they were just trying to find every way around it. So we shouldn't harp on Woods' chipping performance too much, I think, based on what his peers were doing. And the putting seemed fine. He seemed pretty happy with where he was hitting putts. He didn't make everything, obviously, but I don't think guys that are 42 should expect to make everything. The only guy that's 42 that makes everything is a guy that's now 50, that's Steve Stricker, and he still putts brilliantly. But there aren't many guys into their 40s that are still just putting great, great, great. And I would say that list is limited to Steve Stricker and Kenny Perry among modern players in their 40s that did spectacularly well putting and was a calling card for them. That's probably not going to be the case for Tiger. He's not going to be the number one or probably even number five putter on the PGA Tour like he once was at his peak. But he could be a top 20 putter. I think the stroke looked okay. He's never really made huge alterations to that, although he tried to do it a little bit with Foley, which I thought was dumb. But he seems to have gotten back to a stroke that looks more reminiscent of him at his best. And I think that's a positive development. I think all of what he put together looked good. Is it sustainable is the next question. And that's just something we're going to have to find out over time. And I don't mean can he repeat it. I know he can repeat the golf swing. What I mean in that sense is can he stay healthy enough going after the ball at 120 miles per hour? Can he keep doing that? Or is that something he's going to call on and swing normally at 115, 110, kind of smooth it? Is that what it's going to be like? And if that's the case, that's okay. But then don't expect 330, 340-yard drives out on the PGA Tour when he's out there playing. Expect 315, which, hey, that's great. I think every one of us would take 315 with a smash factor of 1.5. You would be super pleased with that. But Tiger Woods may not want to be 10, 15, and 20 yards behind his peers when he plays. So he may try to go after the ball. We'll see what that looks like in terms of his health, and we'll see how long that sustains itself. From everything that I've heard from people who have either had spinal fusion or doctors or people familiar, physios, any of those types of walks of life of people that I've heard from or that I've read about related to spinal fusion was that once you have the fusion, the pain goes away and that it's going to hold for a certain amount of time. And then at a certain point, not having cartilage and having two bones fused together will be a problem. And then there's nothing you can really do about it except change your lifestyle to mitigate the issues. How long that is? Well, it could range. I mean, you can have a spinal fusion that lasts a decade. It lasts 5 years. It varies. So you just kind of have to see, and you just don't know. Obviously, this was a different doctor, a different surgeon than the guy who did the two back surgeries, the second disc microdiscectomy, and the still mysterious third procedure that we don't really know what it was that went back in there a month after. That guy, I'm pretty sure at some point will get sued for malpractice, because whatever he did to Tiger's back, I think was probably, and that's wild speculation, I think probably made things worse. I think exacerbated whatever happened with the first microdiscectomy and maybe not getting it right. I think that guy may have done a huge disservice to Tiger Woods' career, may have shortened it significantly, certainly took away basically 2.5 years, if not 3 years, of Tiger Woods' career by bad back surgeries. And it could also be that Woods' back was just so screwed up that they needed to do it. I don't know. But my inclination, and trying to read through the lines, is that the surgeon probably did not do a good job. And that may mean we were denied the guy that won five times in 2013. But it also could have meant, even if Woods were healthy, going down the path he was going on with Sean Foley, a path I didn't like, that he could have just been ineffective anyway. That even if he were playing regularly, he could have been ineffective. So I don't know, but that's my inclination reading between the lines. So, all right, moving forward, what's the schedule going to be? They tried to talk about that in the booth with Tiger. Very, very interesting of Tiger to give the handshake to Terry Gannon after the fourth round interview, but left Gary Koch hanging. I don't know if you saw it or not, but Gary put the hand out for a handshake, and he was denied by the big cat. And you just hate to see it, but it was funny. And so Tiger, you know, Gary's like, well, when are we going to see you back? We'd love to see you back. I mean, the Yeah, it was a little too fanboy, a little too sycophantic in that interview. But nonetheless, so Woods said, "Yeah, I'm working with my team. We're going to create a training schedule around the major championships." Obviously, he's always scheduled around the major championships. That's not news. But how will you schedule around majors and not get yourself too worked up and leave yourself in a position where you could prematurely end the good done by the spinal fusion? I think that means he can consider Torrey Pines. He can consider the Los Angeles Open, the Genesis Open, which his foundation runs. I think he is a sure thing to play that. Probably a sure thing to play Torrey. He just likes that. Then he can reassess. But I would imagine he's not going back to Phoenix, even though I think he liked playing in that tournament, just performed poorly. I just don't know if he's willing to play that frequently quite yet. Then he would play another two tournaments, I think. He would play Honda because that's a home game for him, and then play the Arnold Palmer Invitational for a variety of reasons. 1 in 8 times wants to honor Palmer. It's in Orlando, not that far from home. All of those things. So there's no plane ride, which is something that I think he's going to consider moving forward. I mean, obviously he can go on his private jet and lay in his bed. That's fine. Although he flew Emirates from San Diego to Dubai to play in that earlier in the year. I don't think you're going to see Tiger Woods doing that anymore. I don't think you're going to see Woods take those 7-figure paydays to go play Middle Eastern events. I just don't think he's going to do it. He'll play the Open Championship because he can take his plane there, and that's that. And he can have the creature comforts of home, whatever he has on his plane. So I think that's what we're looking like toward the Masters. Obviously, he's going to figure it out. There will probably be some checkpoints along the way, you would think, where he assesses after each tournament where he is. Does he want to be more aggressive? Does he not want to be? I would bank on him being extremely conservative leading into the Masters. That he would play the tournaments he typically likes, no more. And that after the Masters, you could say, all right, well, maybe we'll try something different in May. Although he could just play the Players. And again, that could be a car ride if he chooses. Or it could be a quick flight, whatever. But I would think a car ride up to Ponte Vedra, play that. And maybe he plays the Wells Fargo Championship if he chooses, and then that you play Memorial, and then it's U.S. Open, and then that's through June. I think he's looking at a schedule of maybe 15 events, and if it works out that he gets in the FedEx Cup playoffs and he chooses to play, that's a bonus. But I think he's not really concerned about that. I don't think he's trying to get into the World Golf Championships events. That would be a consequence of playing well. I don't think he's trying to get into two FedEx Cup playoff events. Again, a consequence of playing well, but not. I don't think he's going to be a guy that makes 25 starts at best. He's going to make 18 starts, I think. And we can work on what those numbers look like, but of course that's all contingent on what his back is like. I also want to give a shout-out, because I know we just talked about Tiger Woods for 15 minutes. I want to give a shout-out to Ricky Fowler, who I know it's a 18-man event that no one was really grinding over, and Brooks Koepka made $100,000 for finishing like 20 shots behind him. But for Fowler to come from 7 behind and shoot 61 on Sunday and just look absolutely balling out there, 7 birdies to start the round, and by then he had taken the lead, and the tournament was pretty much over because Charlie Hoffman does not close 54-hole leads and probably never will, that was fantastic. And that was not an easy scoring day. I mean, I know obviously Tiger came out the gate looking great and then kind of leaked a little bit into the house. And Fowler found it difficult to find those two birdies to try and shoot 59 on the final two holes. They just weren't there, because 17 is probably the hardest hole in the golf course, and 18 is no easy hole in and of itself. Tough driving area. Green's not hard to hit, but the hole location was not easy to find. And for him to have pulled out 61, which is the best round of his PGA Tour career, unofficially or officially, in an event that is under the PGA Tour umbrella, big deal. Moves him up to number 7 in the world, which we can talk about whether or not this event should have world ranking points. Hint, it shouldn't. But nonetheless, you have to be impressed with what Fowler did, especially coming off of finishing 2nd for what feels like the zillionth time in Mexico to Patton Kizzire. He's had a good fall. I mean, he's had a good, this portion of the 2017-18 schedule has been, the 2017 part has been good to Ricky Fowler. Be curious to see how he leads into it. But we always kind of get revved up about Fowler when he does well, and you go, oh, well, he's got it. He's got the goods to win a major. He's going to do it. And I still believe last year or earlier this year, the PGA Championship, he loves Quail. He's going to win. and didn't quite work out. And I wished it would have for him, because I like the guy personally, and I think that he deserves to earn a major championship with the progress he has made as a professional golfer. But that may not materialize. So I think you have to kind of say about Ricky, these next couple of years, 18, 19, I guess 20, all-inclusive, those 12 majors, that's where he's going to get it or not. If he doesn't there, probably not going to happen, or it's going to be like a Sergio situation where he gets the one-off and everyone goes, finally, that guy won one, and then have no expectations for a second or third major. So we'll see what happens with Ricky. But, hey, close the deal, 61 to finish, course record, personal record as a professional, all those things are pretty cool. And you got $1 million, and you're dating Allison Stokey, so you're doing pretty good for yourself. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back with that insane golf PR story. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Thank you for listening to us throughout the entire year. Thanks for checking us out on Spotify, on iTunes, or the podcast app, which sounds like totally got messed up, and I'm sorry to hear that, but I'm an Android guy, so eh. And whether you check us out on TuneIn or iHeartRadio, shout out to all of you. Thank you for supporting our show. It's been one of our best years ever, and it's only going to get better next year in 2018. We're going to try to do 2 shows a week. Said try. I'm going to try. I'm going to bring some more interviews into the show. It's just between running GNN, and I'm sure many of you who are new to the show don't know this, but I run Golf News Net. I run everything about it. I write it. I edit it. I do the coding. I run the social media. I do the sales. I shoot the videos. I edit the videos. I run these podcasts and edit them and make them dance on the air as best I can. So there's a lot on my plate, but I want to commit to more original content and more stuff that I really like doing. And I love doing this show. This is one of my favorite things to do that is in this business. It's just, I love radio and I love conversation. So that's my pledge, is to try to do 2 a week, and hopefully we will keep up with it. But that said, before we launch into one more show for next year, let's finish this one out. And I want to talk about golf PR for a second. Golf PR meaning public relations, or oftentimes public relations turns into media relations, but kind of follow me here. And I'm going to keep certain names out of this because it's just what I'm going to choose to do. But here's the interesting story. So the other day, I was on Twitter, kind of messing around in the morning, trying to avoid doing work like you probably do when you're on Twitter. Or Facebook, for that matter. And I saw a link from Topgolf. And Topgolf had tweeted out a link to a BuzzFeed piece. And the BuzzFeed piece was supposedly the top 5 companies in golf that are innovating or something like that. Like it pushing boundaries, something along those lines. Some kind of puff-up term. So I was like, okay, this sounds weird. Why would BuzzFeed write about golf? They never write about golf, except unless it involves Donald Trump or Tiger Woods. So why would they write about this? So I clicked through the link, and I went to BuzzFeed, and I quickly realized that the byline is an account, A-Nash21. That's the byline. So it's not a human person's name. It's not Anthony-Nash21 or something like that. It's just A-Nash21. So BuzzFeed has this thing called a community program. And a lot of websites like Huffington Post and Forbes and Business Insider, I think, and others that love the idea of scale, which is having as many web visitors as humanly possible, even if it's to shitty content, and even if it's written poorly and dubious and all that stuff. They do it because that serves ad impressions, and that means they make money. So this is BuzzFeed's version of that called community, where literally anyone can sign up. You go to their sign-up page, you give them their name, you create a branded name, what your byline is, you tell them, I'm signing up, and then you can start writing articles. It's just crazy talk. That's crazy talk. But what the idea behind it is that you create fun listicles and quizzes, so normal people can just kind of screw around at work and have a fun quiz or read a fun list. In that sense, it kind of makes a little bit of sense. But the person, whoever is behind the A-Nash21 account, had written this story and had listed 5 brands. And Topgolf was number 1. And they're certainly innovating. With Top Tracer, it's really cool. watch on TV. They're bringing it to driving ranges that aren't their Topgolf facilities. That's, I think, an innovation. And Topgolf itself is a wildly successful company. And we can debate what their impact on golf is more broadly, but as a company, they're sure as hell very successful, and they're expanding by the minute. Okay. Number two was K-Motion, the people who make K-Vest, which is a really cool teaching product. Helps with kind of motion tracking and gives you 3D visualization of your swing, does some cool stuff. Golf Tech was another. They do golf instruction and golf fitting at their locations. They're all indoors. It's run by PGA of America professionals. Very good stuff. Then there, I think, was Arcos, which is one of the golf game performance tracking companies. They're leading the way. Their technology is very good. They're using Microsoft Cloud, their Azure platform, to really boost this caddy product they've created to kind of give you advice in real time as you play golf, which is illegal for competition, but pretty neat if you're just playing a golf course. And there was one other company, I forget what that is, but I think it was 18 Birdies. It was 18 Birdies, and we work with 18 Birdies, their app and their team, and they're very nice to work with. They supply us some content, video and audio content. They've done some written stuff with us in the past. We have a verified account with them, so we share some of our content on their platforms. Nice little cross-pollinization. It's a cool golf social network. It's a good product. So all five of those just so happen to be clients of the same PR company. All of them. And I know that because I've worked with that PR company in the past, and I've had generally good interactions with them. But I kind of know from experience who has PR over which companies that are substantial in my golf radar. And this PR company was the PR firm for all of those clients. I thought, man, that's kind of strange. I wonder if it's a coincidence. You know me, if you've watched or listened to this show long enough or follow me on Twitter, I am very skeptical and often cynical of people's motivations, of what's behind a decision, that things not aren't what they seem, but that they are what they seem, and if you understand what's behind them. And so I went to this A-21's profile and wanted to see what other stories they had written. Are they just a golf person? Do they write only about golf? Maybe they like golf and kittens. Maybe they like sewing. Maybe they like tools. I don't know. Whatever it is. Maybe they wrote a fun quiz about what kind of dog you would be, or what kind of dog you should own. I don't know. And went there, and the profile had one other article, and had been written, I think it was in August. So this is obviously December, August, so what's that, 3 months? And it was basically about 3 months to the day. And it was a golf article, and it was about the top five golf brands on the rise in 2017. And it's like, okay, I'm curious what's going on here. And clicked into the article, and the golf brands listed were, I think Arcos was on it again. Golf Tech was on it again. GlobalGolf.com, which we have worked with their social team and their team in the past throughout this year. They've been very good to us. They're very nice people. And they run an online golf shop. You've probably seen the commercials if you watch Golf Channel. They're a good shop. And we have an affiliate program with them. So if we sell golf equipment or we lead to a click from our site to them, leads to a sale, we make a couple bucks off of each one of those, like 5 or 6% of the sale price. So that's cool. No problem with that. We like them. And then there was another brand on there, Bridgestone Golf. We're big fans of Bridgestone. I use their golf balls frequently. I have one of their wedges in my bag right now. I've used their iron sets in the past. I like their team. They are wonderful. They are working really hard to grow their business, and I fully support that. But again, I noticed that all five of the companies listed were clients of this same PR firm. So now we've got two lists of five with some crossover, obviously, but what, seven or eight clients all together, all of the same PR firm. That's suspicious. At that point, if you know that, bells should go off on your head and go, wait, wait, wait. So, curious, I reached out to one of the clients in question on these lists, said, can you give me some background on this? And was told that they were told by the PR firm that they work with BuzzFeed occasionally to create golf content. I said, well, that's interesting. Thank you for the information. And then I went to BuzzFeed, and I reached out to their PR team and asked them some questions. Hey, do you have a relationship with this group, this agency? Is there a financial transaction here? Is there a content relationship? What is it? And to BuzzFeed's credit, they got back to me, I think, within 2 hours, maybe an hour. I don't remember now. But they got back to me quicker than I thought was going to happen. I was actually not sure if they would get back to me at all, or if they did, it would be whether it would be a substantive response. And it was their community manager, the capital C community, and that person told me that they do not have a relationship with this PR agency. And on top of that, that they have found this content to be promotional in nature enough to delete the account. So they couldn't tell me for certain if the account was directly related to the PR agency, but that they suspected that it was, because that's the only two articles that were produced by the account. So the account was deleted, and presumably the corresponding content will be as well. Here's something you need to know. I tell you all that story to kind of relay this point. You need to know that in golf and in publishing, more broadly publishing, not just golf, not saying golf is a particularly horrible actor, there are things like this that happen all the time. And I say this about Forbes, I say this about Huffington Post, big websites that you go to and read stuff, especially if you read about golf, on those websites that aren't about golf, that stuff is likely a plant, especially if it's written by someone that is not a staff writer. If it's a staff writer, there's an editorial process you have to go through most times. You have to get approvals. You have to show your copy, show your work. You have to explain to people why you're featuring certain things. There is a thought process that goes, and a scrutiny that goes into that content. But at these websites where literally anybody with credentials, and oftentimes many of these websites, and BuzzFeed I don't think in this case did, but certainly Forbes does and others do, know the background of these writers are typically as PR people or communications professionals that work in a certain industry. They're doing it to fluff up the clients. They're doing it to fluff up their own work and hopefully lead generate from content. And so they produce content that may not be entirely above board or maybe completely below board that promotes certain brands that maybe they work with or aspire to work with. So you need to be cynical. You need to be skeptical, and you need to be someone who reads between the lines when you see stuff like that. Now, I'm not telling you Golf Week or Golf Digest or Golf.com or any of those types of folks are doing what amounts to payola or disingenuous content masked behind a thin veil of PR. Part of that is kind of the nature of the business, right? I mean, you have a relationship with equipment companies. If you write about equipment, they can send you equipment to try. They can invite you to events that they host. They obviously treat you pretty well at these things because, that first of all, they're human beings. But second of all, they want you to come away with a good experience. And then there's the complication that for some, there are advertising relationships, and there's then you still have to cover them editorially. But if you give them a bad editorial rap, then why would they spend money with you? That's their calculation. The journalist's calculation is, I'm a journalist. I should tell you what I really think and what's really true to them. And that may not necessarily be the case for the manufacturer. So it's a weird line. I'm not saying that one's crossed all the time or what it is. I don't know the thought process behind every publication. But it's tough. It's tough in a participatory sport where you try to cover those important companies that are raking in hundreds of millions, if not a couple billion dollars every year. And they can double as advertisers, and they're also the people that you've got to cover, whether that's golf courses, resorts, equipment, other companies, other actors, whatever it is. It's a weird balance. It's hard to strike, and it's easy to criticize. But for companies like BuzzFeed and Forbes and those types of large-scale websites, they don't have to worry about it. They don't care. They don't care about covering golf. So what's it matter to them to have some fluff pieces on there? Doesn't hurt their bottom line at all. In fact, it might help them because they could be perceived in a couple of different ways as friendly to a golf industry, which they have no reason not to be. And if they're friendly to the golf industry, then if they reach the right demographic of golfers or people that golf companies aspire to reach, then that could be a good advertising relationship. They certainly have scale. They reach lots and lots of people, more than golf websites certainly do. And they can maybe form a relationship where you get a little bit friendlier content, a little bit more playful, a little bit out of the box. And if you do it from a PR perspective, then you can say, okay, well, we got a clipping on BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed reaches like 100 million people a month on their website. Now, never mind social. That's amazing. Now, that's not every piece. Now, obviously, every piece doesn't reach 100 million people, and not every piece is popular. And things like their community feature probably don't reach nearly as many people as the stuff on their main website. However, that doesn't necessarily mean anything when you puff your chest out like that and say, hey, we got on the BuzzFeed. And the client goes, whoa, that's cool, man. Never mind if they don't know what the dubious nature behind it or anything like that. So sometimes the lesson is to be skeptical and be an educated consumer about your content. Know where you're reading. Know the people you're reading about. And know the people who are writing it. Because if you know them and you know the backstory, maybe you can kind of identify some things. Be careful who you put your trust in. And I'm not saying not to trust BuzzFeed. They're running a community with probably thousands of contributors. They had no idea this was going on. They probably had none. They probably didn't even know the content existed. They probably would have had to search really hard for it if I didn't tell them where to look. So you kind of have to understand how some things work sometimes. And on my end, as a publisher in golf, I get concerned about things like this. Not because they're not focusing on golf websites. That's fine. I understand you want a broader audience. But creating fluff content that is so overtly disingenuous, is so overtly not grassroots, but astroturf, it damages people like me. Because when we have sponsored posts, and we have some, we label them. They say sponsored post. There's a category on our website, sponsored posts. You can check them out. And when we run native ads, you go to a page on our website, thegolfnewsnet.com/sponsored-post. We make it very explicit. And Google dings us if they were to ever determine that we were creating sponsored content that's not explicitly labeled as so. That's the penalty we could face as a website. Meanwhile, a PR company could skirt that, enhance itself, and then if found out, there's no accountability there because who the hell knows who a Nash 21 is? And all of a sudden, the person who read that or person who now knows that fact say, well, maybe I shouldn't trust any journalists because who knows if they're on the take? And by the way, that exists. I just read a story. Curiously enough, a few hours beforehand on a site called The Outline, and it was a story about how writers for Wired and a lot of tech writers, not really in other industries, but especially in tech, had been approached by companies to write paid content with references to their clients, and they'd be paid hefty sums per article, as much as $5,000, as little as, let's say, $100 per piece. And oftentimes, these were contributors who weren't paid by the website themselves. Again, these contributor programs. So there's no editorial oversight, and there's really no incentive to not do it. And it kind of, not pervasive, but it happens often enough that gives people a bad name. This is something that can give people in my industry a bad name. So I needed to explain it. it bothered me, and this felt like the best possible medium to explain it and why it bothers him and why it should concern you as someone who likes golf or plays golf or whatever. This kind of thing can't go on. It's not okay. It's unethical. It's a disservice to me, to you, to the clients. It's just not good. Sorry we had to end on a bad note. If you want to remember anything about this podcast, remember, smiles about Tiger Woods. All right, next time on the show, we are final show of 2017. We'll talk about some review stuff. We could talk about the Joburg Open, which is played this week for the second time this year, which is weird. And we got a shark shootout, the QBE shootout, the QBE shootout, the former shoot. Wow, that's really bad. The QBE shootout, the former shark shootout to talk about. Got it. We'll talk about that a little bit as well, but focus on 2017. What a fascinating year it was, and what we can look forward to in 2018. If you listen to us on iTunes or through a podcasting app, and you have a review function, please give us a nice 5-star review. It helps us reach more people, and it helps us tell our story to more people, and hopefully more people will enjoy this show. So thank you for listening to us. We really appreciate it. Until next time, our final show of 2017, I'm Ryan Balanchi saying thanks for listening. I'll work on my pronunciation for next time, and we'll see you on the 19th Hole Golf Show.